as you let your body relax, your mind relax. Just notice that there is nothing away from your consciousness. Just as you're relaxing and aware of the sensations of your physical body, as well as the different sounds and rustling in the room, voices outside and traffic. Just as you let yourself relax into the experience of your environment, which includes all that's external to your body as well as your body, your breath, whatever moods may be there in the mind, whatever error thoughts may be passing through. Just relax, totally relax into and accept, be present to all of the sensations and feelings that you're having, whatever they may be. Just be interested in them. Try not to resist them. Just be present. And in that relaxed frame of mind, notice that the entirety of your experience is not separate from consciousness. It's not separate from awareness. Notice that the entirety of your experience is known. The traffic outside, shifts and rustlings in the room, the physical sensations in your body, your five sense organs, your eyes, your ears, your sense of touch, your sense of smell, your sense of taste. Your sense organs are known. The in and outgoing breath is known. Of the thoughts in your mind are known. You are known. You, the one who has the thoughts. You are known. The thoughts are known. the breath is known, the sense organs are known, the body is known, the perceptions are known. The knownness of your experience the knownness of your experience is changeless. The knownness, the consciousness, the awareness, which all perceptions enjoy, is changeless. And because it is changeless, it is asangaha. It is unattached. Unaffected. Always the same. See if you can differentiate the knownness from the object known. The awareness, the constancy, the constancy of your being that is present to and not away from all of the changing perceptions. Let the mind relax into that constancy. Let the mind relax into and be related to that changeless knownness of my being. Let the mind appreciate the changeless in the changing. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavati Tamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. In the second verse of this Hastamalakiya Bhashyam, the verses we're doing at the Bhashyam. Yam agnushnyavan nitya bodha swarupam. Yam agnushnyavan nitya bodha swarupam. Manas chakshuradinya bodhatmakani. Manas chakshuradinya bodhatmakani. Pravartanta ashritya nishkampam ekam. Sarvanta ashritya nishkampam ekam. Sanityo paladdi swarupoham atma. Sanityo paladdi swarupoham atma. Sandhi. Yam agni ushnavat nitya bodha swarupam. Manas manaha Chakshuhu Adini Abodha Atmakani Pravartante Ashritya Nishkampam Ekam Saha Nitya upalabdhi swarupaha aham atma. So, this, the fourth line, Hastamalika, repeats all the way through. It goes, Saha Nitya Upalabdhi Swarupaha Ahamatma. Ahamatma. I am that Atma. Ahamatma. I am that Atma. I am that Self, whose nature, whose Swarupa, is Nitya Upalabdhi. Consciousness, consciousness, knowledge, consciousness, awareness, which is Nitya, timeless. So who am I? Because Shankara asked him. So he says over and over with all these beautiful verses, who am I? I am that self. I am the self whose nature, whose swarupa is pure consciousness. Nitya. Consciousness. Pure, pure means free from time. That means free from change. Free from change means free from duality. Right? It's not caught within, cannot objectifiable. Something that's free from time, past, present, or future, is something that can't be objectified. So not subject to time. Not objectifiable, then it doesn't exist within duality, right? Because there's no going to be no space, no time, nothing like that. So something which is whose swarupa is nitya, free from time, something beyond time, that swarupa is also vishuddha, is also absolutely pure, indivisible, not dual. So anyway, he'll get into that later. But here, so nitya, when you say something is nitya, free from time, there's a lot of significance to that. Right? Because we don't know anything in the creation within the time-space creation that we could say is nitya, is timeless. Everything in the creation is subject to change. Right? Change, time and change go together. That's kind of important to recognize that. If you were to stop time, you would stop change. If you stop change, you stop time. Right? If this world, this the infinitely divisible world that we experience is subject to change, infinitely subject to change, smaller and smaller and smaller parts, all changing, 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 and so infinitely subject to time. Consciousness is not an object in the creation that is subject to time. Consciousness is the very being, the very substrate reality of the creation that itself is non-objectifiable and so therefore changeless. So that's the Nitya Swarupa Atma. So if I say Aham Atma, I am the Atma whose nature, my nature is Nitya Swarupa, Nitya Upalabdhi, timeless consciousness. You know, how do I recognize that? What does that mean? Well, it means like in the meditation that we just did, when you're sitting and you allow yourself to totally relax, you're not resisting any experience. You just simply allow yourself to be with whatever experiences are there, whatever perceptions are there, whatever emotions are there, whatever cramps in your legs are there, whatever it happens to be. There's a totality of many, many different layers of experience taking place at the same time. External perceptions, the sense of touch pervading the physical body, your breath, the awareness of your sense organs, moods and emotions and the ahankara, the I thought, all kinds of things going on in the mind, lots of stuff going on. But all of those things that are going on in your presence. And the fact is that all of these things that are perceived, that are known by you on every level of your being, right, all of the things that are perceived, external, physical body, sense organs, thoughts in your mind, absolutely everything that is perceived, we say, is known. Everything is known. Every cognition, absolutely everything is known. And you also are known. The difference is that you, the one who lights up everything, is yourself not lit up by anything. Right? The example, and Hastamalika even uses, I think uses this example also. Just like the sun, right, lights up everything, including itself. Right? It's not like the sun is dark and everything else is lit up. So the sun lights up everything, including itself. Your being allows for, causes everything to be known, including itself. But in fact, the knownness of everything is the knownness of the self. In all of your experience, when you're sitting there silently, just relaxing into your experience, the noises come and go, the thoughts come and go, the feelings come and go, right? All of those things that are taking place in the knownness. They are all known. And then if you recognize, well, are you known? The awareful being that's illumining them. Say yes. And then you recognize, does the knownness, the awareful being, in which the moods and the emotions and the perceptions are all taking place, is that one changing? Is that one objectifiable? Is that awareness objectifiable as an object? It's known, but it's not known as an object. It's known because it is awareness. And that awareness, which is not objectifiable, remains as the constant being, which is pervasive to all of your experience. And when you say the constant being, there is no other me that you can get to. There's no me behind the awareful being that you are. There's no one else there to light that up. That is the light. And that conscious being, which is me, is changeless. So I need to recognize that changelessness of myself to be able to say, who am I? I am that self, which is, whose nature is changeless consciousness. I just have to recognize that reality. I don't have to go anywhere for it. I simply have to recognize the fact that right now, at this moment, I am here. And this I that is here remains changelessly present in the midst of all my changing experiences, which includes the I thought, I am doing this, I am doing that, I am thinking this, I am thinking that, I am meditating, I am listening to class, I am, I am, I am. That's known. The thoughts in your mind are known. Right? The moods are known. The body is known. The breath is known. The sense organs are known. The perceptions are known. The whole thing is known. And so in your experience, you see that in fact, there is nothing in your experience that's not known. And that knownness goes to the core of your very being. Right? So I would say the knownness, the awareness is you, and then everything shines after you. If I say everything shines after you, why we even make any kind of distinction between you and the objects of perception that are not in any way away from you, to have yourself and an object over here, there's nothing away from your awareness. But still, there is the changeless amidst the changing. This Maya that's responsible for the whole projection of this creation, everything that we experience within duality. This whole thing, right, comes and goes. It changes. And I don't. And so even though these experiences I have no distance from me or no separation from me, they're not away from me. The being that they enjoy is constant. I'm not. This world is not. You see what I'm saying? So now when Hasta Malika says, Shankara asks him, who are you? He is really saying who he is. It's not just an idea. The reality is that the I, when you say I am, the person that you are referring to right now is Nitya Upalabdhi, is changeless. Your being right now is changeless awareness. And you either recognize it or you don't. If you don't recognize it, that means you're superimposing things upon it. You haven't recognized it in its own right. And that's what needs to be done. So here he says with this, I am that Atma whose nature is timeless, Nitya Upalabdhi, timeless awareness. Who Agni Ushnavat Nitya Bodhisvarupa, whose Swarupa, again, Swarupa, whose nature is Nitya Bodha. Nitya means timeless. Bodha is another word like Upalabdhi, means jnanam. Timeless knowledge. Okay? Timeless knowledge. I'll tell you how we use it, Bodha now in Upalabdhi, but whose Swarupa is Nitya Bodha, like what? Agni Ushnavat, like the heat and fire, like the heat of fire. It's not that you are something, some substance, some object that has consciousness as an attribute that could be removed. Just like heat is fire, you can't take the fire away from heat. You can't take the consciousness away from your being. And so what's being said here is that your being, the existence, the amness that you enjoy when you say, I am, I exist, that being is itself consciousness. It doesn't have the existence, the being that you enjoy doesn't have consciousness as an attribute. It is consciousness. And so just like heat is not an attribute of fire, you can't remove the heat from the fire. Like that, you can't remove the consciousness from your being. So depending upon this ashritya, depending upon this consciousness, which is your being, he says, the mind, manaha, the sense organs, chakshu, adi, etc. I'll tell you what that means in a minute. But the mind and the eyes, chakshu means eyes, the mind and the eyes, etc., which are abhoda atmakani, which are by nature, atmaka means by nature, which are by nature insentient. The mind, the eyes, etc., which are by nature insentient, they pravartante, they are active. Okay? So the upadis, which by nature are insentient, mean they have no consciousness in and of themselves. Because of that consciousness, which is timeless being, and whose nature is, where the existence that you are is by its nature, bodha is by its nature, knowledge or consciousness, depending upon that being, your mind, etc., are active. So he says, that self, that atma, which is nishkampam and ekam. The atma, the self, which is nishkampam. Nishkampam means it doesn't shake. Kampa means to shake. Okay. The self is nishkampam. It's just another way of saying it's not subject to any type of disruption, any type of change whatsoever. And that atma is ekam. So that which is ekam, ekam means one. Okay. That atma which is one, which is nishkampam, not subject to any type of shaking or changing in any way. Okay. That the manas, the mind, depending upon that self, becomes active. Now when they say manas and chakshuadi, in Sanskrit, when you take a word that is part of a set, like manas means mind, and add adi to it, it will include the whole set. So if I say manas adi, the mind, etc., it stands for the mind, the intellect, the ahankara, the memory, all of the different parts of the mind. So if I say manasadi, every part of the mind in total, the eye notion, the buddhi, the intellect, the fluctuating mind, the memory, all of the components of the mind, all of those which in themselves are inert, depend on that awareness in order to be active. Without that awareness, they couldn't move. They would be inert, insentient. Chakshu adi means the eyes. Chakshu means eyes. It's going to stand for the five sense organs. So the eyes, ears, sense of touch, sense of smell, sense of taste. All of your five sense organs, without the consciousness, they also are abodha and can't act. Okay. So then again, your organs of action. So all of the chakshu is for the sense organs, all the organs of action. Your ability to grasp, your ability to walk, your ability to speak, evacuate, have sex, five of them. Those are the five what we call karmendras. All of these things, can't function without the consciousness. And so the conscious being is called, from the standpoint of the upadis, all of these, you know, the body, mind, sense organs complex, is called the adhishtana, the adhishtatra, means the presiding deity. The self is the presiding deity. Because without a conscious being, there could be no activity, there could be no perception, there could be no action, it would just be inert. And so, the Maya, in this whole relationship between the sense organs, body, mind, has got to be understood experientially. So let me just talk about that for a minute. When you sit, I just want to kind of take it to your own experience as a human being in meditation. We use meditation or nididhyasana, what we call nididhyasana, to slow down this teaching, to give your mind really a chance to recognize what's being said. We want you to recognize it when the unfoldment is actually taking place. But sometimes when you slow everything down, you put the teaching in slow motion, you can actually see, you know, oh, actually, this is actually how it is. Yeah? You can see that at the time of teaching also. But then, boy, this is hard to teach over this.
Yeah.
These guys are getting into my mind. For you too? Yeah. Oh, nice. Well. They're having a good time out there.
Good.
Yeah.
No, they were fighting.
Really? There we go. This park is very active. That's a good thing. It's good. A lot of people use it. This is the paradox of your experience. Not a paradox because it's understandable, but at the same time it's paradoxical. You don't do anything. Awareness, your being, me, your own presence, is not acting. You are not seeing. You are not thinking. You are not hearing. You are the conscious being that is present and not away from, in any way, all of these functions. But you yourself aren't doing anything. So thinking is going on, but you're not thinking. Hearing is going on, but you're not hearing. That's that verse really confuses people. People who don't understand Vedanta, and they hear that verse, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita, the person is seeing is happening, but I'm not seeing. Hearing is happening, but I'm not hearing. Then how you can relate to that is, oh, the person who really has knowledge, who's talking to me, they're talking to me, but they're not really talking to me. They're hearing. Hearing is going on, but they're not hearing. It's ridiculous. However, there's some truth in it. But you have to understand the standpoint. You have to see that, you have to experience the truth of it right now while you're seeing and while you're hearing and while you're talking. You are not seeing and you are not hearing and you are not talking. However, with the upadhi, because there is a body here which is not away from awareness, you are seeing and you are thinking. and feeling and talking and moving. All of this activity is very much taking place because this upadhi is here and this upadhi is not away from awareness. And so from the standpoint of the upadhi, or from the standpoint, you could even say like this, I, with the upadhi, see. I, with the upadhi, hear. I, think. With this faculty, this is a nice way to look at it, with these faculties, which in no way change me, in any way, they come and they go, they work or they don't work. The physical body, all of this, all that exists within Maya, but just look at the individual upadhi. With these upadhis, which don't change me, I see, I hear, I talk, I feel, I walk, all of these things. At the same time, I don't do any of those things. Now, what's beautiful about to understand this, because I want you to understand it, have the words go to your experience, even when you're sitting in meditation. Okay? You are hearing. Right? You are feeling your body. You're aware of the thoughts passing through. Right? And you're also, if your mind was able to recognize this, you're also not doing anything. Both things are absolutely true. The thoughts are going on in your mind, right? Because from the standpoint of the upadhi, you know what I mean by that? The upadhi here is the mind. From the standpoint of the mind, it is your mind. Right? Because as long as that mind is there, it's not at all away from you, from consciousness. As long as that mind is there, it has no separation from consciousness. And so that mind is going on thinking, and as it goes on thinking, if you gain knowledge, you are recognizing, the mind itself is recognizing that it is thinking and feeling and perceiving, doing all of these functions, while I am not. And you'll notice that the mind itself completely enjoys awareness. You wouldn't say that, oh, the mind is inert, as though there's something inert here and awareness here. There's no separation from the awareness and the mind. Here, Hastamalika is saying, this mind is abodha. It is inert. Means this. It itself has no consciousness apart from me. It's not that the mind has a consciousness. That is not me. The consciousness that the mind enjoys is me. And the mind completely enjoys consciousness. Not partially. It completely enjoys consciousness. Like the pot completely enjoys the clay. Right? There is no separation. Right? So when you sit and you recognize, gee, this thought is conscious. The ahankara is conscious. The emotions are conscious. They are known. There's no separation. So now, you have to make your mind has to make a shift and recognize that even though the upadhi is not away from me, not away from consciousness in any way, and it enjoys being known and enjoys consciousness, you have to be able to see that while that is true, what is also equally true, or more true even, is that I am not changing. The consciousness itself never changes. The mind never doesn't enjoy consciousness, but the consciousness never changes. And the mind always changes. Then you notice, the perceptions always change. They're not away from or separate from me, separate from consciousness at all. They are known. But they go on modifying and changing. The consciousness The me does not modify or change. That's why he says nishkampam. All kinds of things are going on in the mind and in the sense organs and in the perceptions. And that's my experience. But my experience is also that as all of these things are going on, and enjoy me fully, need me, are me. Right? They are me, but I'm not them. Right? It's just like the clay is free from the pot, but the pot's not free from the clay. I am free from these things in that I am nishkampam, I am changeless, I am asangaha. Asanga is a very important word. Asangaha means I may be totally pervasive in the very being of all of these things, but at the same time, I have no attachment because they come and go and I don't. And so my actual experience is as these thoughts or perceptions, all change, is going through its process of changing, the one thing that is not going through any process of change whatsoever is the knownness of those things. The thing which is known goes, but the knownness doesn't. It's just now something else is known, and then something else is known, and then something else is known. So that knownness is the constant. It's kind of like the air, or it's the very fabric. It's the very being of this creation. It's the constant being of this creation, which is my own being. Right? It's the constant non-objectifiable being of this creation. And so when you slow yourself down, when you slow everything down, you recognize then the changeless presence of yourself that you can do nothing about, and the changing phenomena of your mind and of your perceptions, of your sense organs. Those go on changing, and they, as long as they are there, they are conscious. They are thinking, right? They are seeing. They are perceiving. But what allows them to do that? They don't have being or consciousness of their own. The being or the consciousness remains constant, but as long as the upadhi is there, the upadhi is an expression of that consciousness. You see what I'm saying? So you need to recognize, to differentiate the constancy of your being, which is non-objectifiable, it's always exactly the same, from all of these perceptions that you have. So here, he says, depending upon this ashritya, depending upon that atma, which is not, it's just nitya, changeless, free from time, that bodha, that knowledge that is free from time, all of these things, depending on those on that knowledge, all of these things are active. Pravartante means they're active. There's no activity apart from them. In the first part, he uses the word bodha. Bodha means knowledge. So the doubt in the bhasha, the doubt can come. How can you use the word bodha, knowledge? What do you mean? So there's a discussion. Bodha, the word bodha is a synonym for chaitanya, for consciousness. When we think of bodha, knowledge, we think of the word bodha in terms of jnanam. Jnanam means cognition. And so we think, this is how we think until we understand until we look at our experience from the viewpoint of an Upanishad, until we look at the experience that way. When we have a cognition, we think now we have a piece of knowledge. This cognition and the knowledge are one. And so now we have this knowledge. Then we have another cognition. Now we have this knowledge. What we think is that the knowledge belongs to the cognition. And so that's normally what we think. This is a piece of knowledge. This is a piece of knowledge. This is a piece of knowledge. And we think of it like that, that the cognition is the piece of knowledge, because the cognition is known. So like if I look at that painting, right? Now this painting is known. I have a cognition of the painting. Now I have knowledge of it because the painting is known. And so the knowledge now, the knowledge experience that I have when I gain a vritti of the painting, right, the knowledge experience that I have is now superimposed on the cognition. And so I say, this is knowledge, and this is knowledge, and I have knowledge of this, and I have knowledge of that. And that's fine. We talk that way. We're giving knowledge to every cognition, and we're collecting them. We're collecting our knowledges. However, here, the knowledge is the nitya bodha. Nitya bodha means the knowledge which is timeless. The knowledge that doesn't go when the cognition goes. Right? And so actually, the word bodha is a powerful use of this word here. Because in fact, it's every single cognition that you have, that cognition is known. But the knownness, the bodha, the knowledge of the cognition is actually nitya, is actually timeless. Right? So what is happening is the cognition is enjoying timeless knownness. The cognition enjoys timeless awareness, and then that awareness is superimposed upon the cognition, so that now the object of knowledge, it is an object of knowledge. It has the knowledge. In reality, everything has the knowledge equally all the time as long as it's there, because the knowledge is Brahman. The knowledge is the awareness itself. And so the experience of knowledge, in fact, doesn't come and go. The experience of knowledge is the constant. The experience of knowledge is nitya. It's free from time. And so we're all seeking, right, to know more, to know more, to know more, to know more. But in the end, we recognize that the knowledge, we can't know more. We can't know more, that our very swarupa is the knowledge, which then we're trying to accumulate through the accumulation of cognitions. You see what I'm saying? We're trying to accumulate the knowledge through the accumulation of cognitions, where in fact, I am the knowledge that illumines all of the cognitions. Right? So the knowledge is the conscious awareness. So when you think of it in your experience, absolutely everything comes into knowledge, and the knowledge itself is full. It's non-objectifiable. So the knowledge itself is limitless. It's changeless and it's limitless. This changeless, limitless knowledge is now superimposed upon all of the objects in the world, everything that you know. And so that's why when you're sitting kind of silently in meditation, to recognize it is known, 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 period. There is nothing else. And let that is knownness come just to you. When you say, I am, I exist, I am a conscious being, me, let that knownness land there. And then see, is there any consciousness, any knownness, any being really apart from your own being? Try to separate it. Try to separate your consciousness, the conscious being that you are, into two parts. There aren't two parts. There's one presence, and that one presence, everything else exists in. Right? We say, when Hasamalaka says this is abodha, the mind is abodha, it's not consciousness. That means it doesn't have another consciousness, because there's only one consciousness. So why don't you say, well, it's consciousness too? Because there's not two. There's only one. Why do you have to say then it's a bodha? Because if there's only consciousness, why do you even say that there's a bodha? If you say bodha, consciousness, awareness, is nitya, is timeless, then you're saying, and there is nothing but that, right? And it's one. Then you say, this is all a bodha. Why? Because you have to be able to differentiate your experience. And I have to be able to see in this world of multiplicity that I experience all of the different forms, all of the different perceptions that I have, all of you, and here's me. right? And all of the different thoughts I have and all of the different feelings that I have. I have to see all of these things, you know, as mitya. I have to see them as mitya, not as something which is non-existent. Because we can't say this is all non-existent. So say if I say there's only consciousness here, there is no duality here. Well, that's true. There is it. There is only consciousness here, and there is no duality here. You say, well, but what's all this? Then I can either say, you know, like some of these stories that they'll say that confuse people like crazy. Well, the seeker travels up the mountain, and, you know, in India, going up the Himalayas, and it's day after day struggling to come to the teacher, and finally gets that worn out, you know, cold out, and finally gets up the top of the mountain to meet the teacher, you know, and he asks the guru, you know, oh Bhagavan, you know, what is the truth of the world? And the teacher says, what world? There is no world. It's true, on one level. But that's quite a confusing thing to say. That would be like saying, holding up the clay pot in a way and saying, asking the teacher, you know, what is the pot? And the teacher says, what pot? Well, you know, you can say that kind of like a koan, and then the student starts going, okay, it's only clay. The student gets it. It's only clay. But this is not that easy to get. Right? You're experiencing the entire world of duality. You know, and I'm here and you're there, and obviously there's a world that we're experiencing. How do you account for it? If the substance, if the very being of this is only consciousness, changeless consciousness, there is nothing but consciousness. Changeless, non-dual consciousness that is not energy moving around. Because there's no space. If it's one without a second, if it's pure consciousness, pure awareness, nothing else, homogeneous, just pure awareness, no borders, no second thing, no space, no time, you know, just pure, undivided awareness. That pure awareness can't become anything. There's no place for it. It has no parts itself, and there's nothing that it is not. There's no holes in it. Like if you think of clay or something, you can. There's other things besides clay. Clay is surrounded by space, so you can move it. It stays as clay, but you can move it into pots and plates and whatnot. Awareness is non-dual. It doesn't have any space around it. It has no space around it. It has no space within it. It has no parts. Where is it going to move? How is it going to change? How is the awareness going to change to become anything? It's got no parts. There's no second thing. There's no time. There's no space. Nothing. And so that awareness cannot become, it's not like little atoms of energy. See, sometimes we want awareness to be energy. And, you know, then the energy can move and become the, well, that's good for Maya. We can look at Maya like that. Maya can fall into that type of talk because Maya does have parts. In the sense that we can differentiate things. We have Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, and we've got the five elements, and we have, it can do things. That's even problematic. I'll tell you, if we really got into it, we can't really even separate the Maya into parts. That's another thing. But experientially, as I'm looking through my sense organs, I can see, right, these parts. Because I can see this creation, I need to account for it. Remember this also. And because it's here to be accounted for. You know, it's not like the Shastra will use an example like the son of a barren woman. It's one of a famous example. The son of a barren woman is an example of something that is not there. Another, they use a city in the sky as an example for something, the horn of a rabbit, for something that's not there. It's not experienceable because it doesn't exist. You can't say that about this creation. So you have to understand it. You have to account for it. We say that this creation is mitya because we experience it, but when we analyze it, there's nothing here but consciousness. That's what happens. When you analyze this creation, there's nothing here but your being. That's it. Because everything here that you take to be something is really just an infinitely divisible conglomerate. There's no thing here. It's impossible, in fact, to find something here apart from existence being itself. The being that all of these things enjoy is one non-objectifiable being, which is yourself. Everything else that you experience here is divisible, divisible, divisible into smaller and smaller parts until finally you have to realize that when you finally take off this hypothetical smallest part, to take off the form, you end up with substance, which is formless. Right? At the bottom of it all, there is formless substance, which is yourself. And that, in fact, as you go trying to find a substance in this creation, you know, like say if you start with an object, that object is known. So now we're going to analyze it. Okay, I have an object. The object is known. We break it into smaller objects. Now that object is no more. It is gone. It never was there in the first place. It was only a conglomerate. Now I know that I've broken it into smaller objects. Now those objects are, and they are known. Right? Nothing happened to the being. Nothing happened to the knownness. The object has been dismantled. Then I take another smaller piece of the object and I dismantle that. Now, that object was known. Now the dismantling is known and the dismantled is known. Right? It is and it is known. The isness, the is-knownness never wavers, never wavers. No matter how small you go, you know, what remains as the constant is the very being in which this dismantling takes place. And so everything always remains known. But the knownness is not an object. The knownness, the being, which all these things enjoy as you dismantle them, that knownness, that being is not an object. That knownness, that being is me. The non-objectifiable me, which is non-objectifiable, meaning it's not an object, there can't be two. Right? So that's why it's ekam, it's one, it's nishkampam. You can't shake it, you can't change it, because this being that all of these things seem to enjoy as it is, it is, it is, it is, it is, this isness is actually just projected onto all of this. There is no isness out there. I am the isness. I am the being. There's not two experiences of being. And so when I recognize that, that the being that all of these things experience is me, then I can say there's nothing here but consciousness. But initially, I need to make that differentiation that you're there, I'm here. The mind, I differentiate from the mind. The mind has no consciousness apart from me. Therefore, I call it a bodha, okay? A thought. I say the thought has no consciousness away from me. I illuminate. It enjoys consciousness that is me. But it is a bodha. It is not conscious itself. Why do I say that? Because I want to differentiate the changing thoughts from the changeless me. See what I mean? In the end, I can say it's all just consciousness because I understand the mityatva, that this changing phenomena has no substance, no reality of its own apart from me. So all of this is just, is simply consciousness. But I can't say that until I recognize that there is nothing of substance here apart from consciousness. And at the same time, as long as this is here, I'm here with this upadhi, and you're here with your upadhi, and you're here with your upadhi, there's what we call a vyavaharika reality. That we're all enjoying all these upadhis, which all are mitya, all are maya, are enjoying the same order of reality so we can, you know, negotiate, talk, relate. We can have relationships. We can do everything. And that's all great and fine. But you need to, in order for this to all be great and fine, and to be wonderful, and isn't this fabulous, this wonderful infinite universe, we have to know what it is. Because otherwise, you know, I need to be happy. I need to be free. I need to be full. And as long as I think that my happiness, my well-being, my fullness is dependent on something out here, that's tough. Because that doesn't work. And so that ignorance, that self-ignorance that the mind has, that causes me to take myself to be the upadhi, right? And to search for my well-being out here, that ignorance causes a lot of havoc. And so we painstakingly have to go through this whole process. And it is painstaking, and it is extremely detailed, because it's not an easy thing for the jiva, this individual, these upadhis, who are caught within the creation, to be able to say, I am the whole. It has to, there's a lot of understanding that has to take place there. I like to use the example of if you're having a dream, if you're a character in the dream, what that character has to understand, to know, to have nishta, to have clarity, to know that I'm the whole, means to know that myself is the one from whom the whole dream comes, sustains the dream. This is the character in the dream. That character needs to know that when that character says, you know, like Hastamalaka says, I am the nitya upalabdhi swarupa atma. That's what that character in the dream is saying, that I am that atma. I am that self that is really a changeless consciousness. You know, the one from whom the whole creation comes, who sustains the whole creation, and the one into whole creation resolves. I am that whole. And so that recognition, and to understand it, to see it, the mind needs to ask a lot of questions. You know, it has to gain clarity. It has to gain clarity. The mind is not happy not understanding. This is another, I'd say, great falsehood that's been passed on in the name of spirituality. Oh, the mind can never know, can never understand. The mind has to be transcended. The mind doesn't want to be transcended. You know, the mind wants to understand. And it isn't a matter of transcending. You can't transcend yourself. You can't transcend yourself. You are already yourself. The problem has nothing to do with transcending. You would have to transcend yourself. You can't transcend yourself. The problem has to do with knowing yourself. The mind that takes, the mind is the one, you know, that has the problem. And the mind is the one that needs the solution. And it's true, it's so beautiful in the Mandukya Upanishad. It's, you know, the mitya mind has the mitya bondage and needs the mitya solution. The mitya mind that has the mitya pain needs the mitya relief. You know? And so somebody might say, well, if it's only mitya, why do I need it?
Because it hurts.
Yeah, because it hurts. You know? Yourself Atma doesn't need anything. But this mind and this upadi is capable of a lot of pain. And why should I have that pain? Once at some point it asks, why should I have this pain? Isn't there a solution to this problem? Isn't there a solution to this problem? Okay, let's stop there. Just take a minute. Om Purnamidam Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vishishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Problem and the one who has to know is the mind, and it's the awake mind that has a problem and that needs to know.
Deep sleep mind won't have a problem.
Right, right. So the awake mind wants to know, but the awake mind in itself is in duality, and it's limited in time and space. It's limited in time to whatever this lifetime or the time that it's awake during this lifetime, and then it's limited in space to this loka or this abadi.
Right.
But what it needs to know is that its being is not limited. But so you know, for the limited to know what is, to know with Nishtha, which is unlimited.
No, but wait, you're talking about as though the limited is the self.
No, I'm talking about limited being the mind.
Okay, but the truth of the mind, which is the self, is limitless, means free from time. You have to be careful that you don't think of limitless like limitless,
right.
But think of it as being the changeless,
being
limitless, non-objectifiable subject.
Right, not of creation, not of time and space.
Yeah, but also not away from the mind, so that when the mind, the thought says, I am, so you say the mind says, I am the conscious being, and it means I, the mind, am the conscious being. It's like saying, I, the mind, am me. So the me and the mind are taken to be one. That's the ajnani. Now, what about when the mind recognizes that the me, that it's me, the mind's me, is actually a sangha, unattached in the sense that all of the thoughts of the mind do not, in fact, change the truth of the mind, the me of the mind. That's the freedom.
Right.
Because until then, the mind takes it. So if the mind is sad, the self has become sad. If the mind is happy, the self is happy. If the body dies, taking another step, if the body dies, the self dies. If the body is sick, the self is sick. That's not a sangha. That's identity.
Right. But say that the mind makes that differentiation.
Yeah.
And it can experientially know that. But it can experientially know that only in the waking state. What it needs to know is that even when it's not in the waking state, that even when, you know, the body dies, that its being exists. But that can be known logically by the mind. That cannot be known experientially.
Well, that's not quite true because of if you understand the nature of something, like a differentiation, then that differentiation between something that is non-objectifiable and something that exists within duality, you can extend it.
Probably that's a logical extension. But
it's a logical extension that is firm knowledge, because, like, for instance, if I can recognize, here we are sitting in this room, if I can recognize a differentiation between my being, this physical body, sense organs, mind, perception of this room, and I can recognize the asangaha nature of myself in reference to the totality of the experience in this room, there is nothing to stop. There's no possibility of that becoming attached to anything further external. You're looking at the relationship between something, my being, which is non-objectifiable, and everything else, which is. And so if you understand that relationship, it doesn't matter whether it is in heaven or it is across, on another planet or in another life. It doesn't make any difference, because you're talking about the relationship of something within time and space to something which is non-objectifiable.
Right. But, what I mean is that is true, and that is where the nishtha comes in, but the nishtha comes in logically to the awake mind. The nishtha comes in a very deep understanding which is available to the waking mind. And it is the experience, the waking mind knows that the total experience can be differentiated into what is changing and what is changeless. But it seems that when, for the rest of the experience, when I am in deep sleep or when I am dreaming or after, before I was born or after I die, that in those times, there is, because there isn't a mind to have a problem at all, that it just doesn't matter. So it's
that's true.
That it's enough for the waking mind to really know experientially. So there's nothing else to know experientially except for the waking mind to know it experientially.
Yes, but there's something missing. I think that what you're saying is primarily true, but one thing that is missing, I think, is that the self experience, the self experience is an independent experience.
But the knowledge of that, when I'm in waking state, I know there is something to know.
Right.
But when I'm in deep sleep,
There's nothing to know in terms from the standpoint of the mind, because the mind is in manifest condition.
Right.
So it's really a non-issue from the standpoint.
Right,
that's true. That is true. But still, there's something, I'm just not convinced.
That's the reason I'm asking the question, is that because you always stress in class that, it's an experiential knowledge. And that was my question, that the experiential knowledge is really only...
Well, what I keep trying to say, more than experiential knowledge, whenever I say that, I'll go around and say, actually, it's knowledge of the experience. Right? Because I don't, when I do use sometimes the word experiential knowledge, but when I use it, I will counterpoint that with saying that it is knowledge of the experience which is here. And that's just a subtle difference, but I am a conscious being, and I need to, and the mind is what the mind is, the sense organs, so we have this experiential reality here that includes myself.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I need, my mind does not, is ignorant of this, of the nature of myself. So it hasn't differentiated myself, my being, from these upadis. And so the mind needs to gain knowledge of this experience. It needs to understand this experience. It needs to recognize the difference between its nature, its
mm-hmm.
thinking and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
and me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the me experience is exactly the same. Whether or not the mind says, I am the me,
And I think that's always the question that comes up. When you say that the me experience is always the same,
right.
That is something for the waking mind to understand logically. But that is not something that the mind is going to know, because the mind is not always present.
I don't like what you just said in terms of this part of it. When you say the mind is going to understand logically, no.
Mm-hmm.
It understands, the mind has direct, immediate knowledge. It's called aprokshajnanam. Of the self. There's no inference, there's no logic involved.
I meant only in the waking state. I meant that the mind is not going to have a parokshagyanam.
Okay, so then you're saying, how will I know for sure that when the body dies?
That's what I'm saying.
You will know first of all, okay, there's a couple of levels to this. One, even to know that there's like reincarnation or the nature of Ishwara, that's all from the Shruti. So even say, how do I know that I transmigrate? Mm-hmm. You don't know.
Yeah.
No, that's a belief.
So that is not experiential.
That's not, it'll be experiential when you do it.
Right.
Okay, but it makes sense, and it's the vision of the Shruti, the same Shruti that gives you this knowledge,
right.
Makes you understand this, and it's kind of the world view, and it makes sense.
Right.
But what you need to understand right here and now in this body, right, and understanding reincarnation is very useful for understanding punya and papa, dharma and adharma, and all of these things. So there's a lot of reasons to understand thoroughly what the Shruti has to say in terms of the world view of the creation. It's very, very useful for making sense of dharma and adharma and inequality and so many other things. It works very, very well to understand our experience, why I had this body, these parents, all of that type of thing. But now, here and now, with this body, with waking, dream, deep sleep, with seer-seeing differentiation, here and now, you can have direct, immediate knowledge, not inference, of the nature of yourself and the mityatva of this creation.
But isn't the inference involved when it comes to knowing that this remains, that myself remains the same, even when my mind is in deep sleep or even when I'm dead? Isn't that inference?
I don't think so. And the reason is this. Once you realize that there's a subject-object differentiation, that the self, consciousness itself, is limitless, is non-objectifiable, is changeless. This is all going to be aprokshajnanam, not, When that's the case, in this situation here, it can't change to become something else. It doesn't matter if the jiva transmigrates. If this is true here, it will be true everywhere. Because this is not capable of change by its very nature.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Boop, boop, boop. Yes.
Well, just springboard for a question about, so this is true with this upadi, you have experience, right?
With the upadi, you have sensory perception, you have experience of anything that the experience the upadis can give you.
Right. But then you die, and you have, you know, maybe there's some in-between stage, and there's, you know, no... Right.
Well, from the Hindu perspective or the Vedanta unfoldment, this physical body is called the stula sharira, the physical or gross body.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sukshma sharira or subtle body that reincarnates and will take other bodies. So that subtle body will continue to reflect awareness just like it does as it's abiding in this physical body. But as long as I have a physical body, this one, that is of the same material as this particular plane of existence, I will be experiencing this plane of existence with the use of this physical body. When this body drops, the subtle body takes on another form depending upon what sphere of existence it's going to be existing in to fulfill its karmas and whatnot. But there, just like here, It's the same me, changeless me, that is present in the very self of that subtle body. So there is no death experience. There'll be a change of experience, you know, but there's no death experience at all. Then once knowledge takes place, when a person gets what we call nishta, you know, really rooted in this knowledge, then at that time there is no more identification, no more ignorance to cause for identification with these upadis. And so at that time a person then is just the whole, Ishwara. Because there's nothing to make you take on that limitation again.
Well, you know, I just wanted to say, in a dream, that's kind of interesting too. Sometimes in a dream, there's a recognition. Why is it, you know, something like the dream character experiences in a way, well, I've had dreams like that, you know, where I would be just in the most bizarre dream.
Yeah.
And within the dream, there's a recognition, I'm not this. And it kind of, somehow there's a kind of a, it feels like a parallel recognition that what we're working here on.
Well, if you have knowledge in this life, you can have dreams that are jnani dreams.
Yeah, that's what I was
You can have agnani dreams too. That's just the vasanas, or you know, the dreams are a lot of things coming out. So you can have a jnani dream.
Yeah.